Conclusion. Burn it down. There was something missing from that last chapter. Me. I'm not a parent and, barring some dramatic life shift, won't be. People have all sorts of reasons for not having kids. They're unable to conceive. They don't particularly like kids. They don't think they'd be good or stable parents. They just don't want to. I don't have kids for multiple reasons, all of which can ultimately be traced back to burnout in the culture it promotes. Like an ever-growing number of millennials, I've delayed adult milestones. I didn't get a 401k until I was 31. I didn't buy a house until I was 37, and then only because I moved out of New York. I'm still not married and don't plan to be, not because I don't have long-term plans with my partner, but because I just don't see the need. And then there's the kids. If I get pregnant right now, my pregnancy would be considered geriatric. But did I choose to delay these things, or did societal realities make it difficult to do anything other than delay them? You can disagree with the decision to go to grad school, but I made it with the agreed-upon understanding that it would culminate in a steady job. I finished my program as quickly as I could, but not quickly enough to graduate before age 30. I knew of other people who had babies in grad school. Do it while you have healthcare. You can write your dissertation while the baby sleeps. But I was already working all the time. Doing the same amount of work while also taking care of a baby seemed nothing short of miraculous. I graduated and spent the following years chasing jobs across the country with barely $1,000 in my savings account. Also not the optimal time to have a baby. And then I became a journalist, living in New York in an apartment barely large enough for a dog, paying a quarter of my salary in student loan payments every month. Meanwhile, my friends started getting pregnant. They talked about strollers, expensive, and birth plans, even more expensive. I barely had enough money saved to cover either. Then they started talking about childcare plans and how their parents would cover one day or two. I realized I'd have none of that. They talked about nannies and nanny shares and paying double what I had been paid just over a decade before. How could I cover even a portion of those costs and New York rent and my student loan payment? One friend quit the workforce altogether. Another went to a four-day week but was still putting in the same amount of work. There was no place to pump, in private, at work. Even the most ardently feminist of my friends seemed resigned to letting their husband perform far less than the equal amount of labor. I saw how hard they were working every day and how the exhaustion accumulated. They loved their kids so much. I loved their kids. I love kids. I was a nanny. They made it work. Why couldn't I? That phrasing is instructive. They made parenting work. More work, endless work, compounding work. Children used to be a labor necessity, a mouth to feed, but one that also ameliorated the amount of work to be done. But contemporary parenting standards mean that children become the work. You must work outside the home to get enough money to pay for their concerted cultivation, but also all the labor of concerted cultivation itself. The books I'd need to read, the groups I'd need to join, the stultifying group music classes I'd need to attend, the school choice stress I'd need to resist, the judgment I'd internalize and let expand within me until it devoured me entirely. Work, work, work. That's why I couldn't see myself doing it. I was already working myself into the ground, spreading myself thin, barely getting by. More work without support, without accommodation or understanding, felt like it would disintegrate me entirely. I know the objections. People make parenting a priority. And if you found yourself in that position, you could figure it out. But my industry and my specialty within it was already so precarious. Take away my ability to work all the time, and you take away my ability to distinguish myself. Sure, I'd have a baby that I loved. I'd also probably be un- or underemployed. When people consider having a kid, they often talk about making the math work in order to make it possible. They'd stop spending money on this budget item or enlist a family member to replace an afternoon of care. Or they convince themselves with various amounts of convenient delusion that it won't be that hard, or that the hard part would only last a short amount of time. I just could not make the math work, financially most of all. But even when I'd moved away from New York and found myself in a more stable financial situation, I couldn't make the math work in a different way. I'd worked so damn hard over so many years and had finally landed with the help of a lot of luck, in a place of tentative security, in my job, in my personal life, with my partner. I'd read enough and observed enough to know how, in my particular scenario, children would explode all of that. Now, I want to be very clear. Children themselves aren't social problems. Children are great. When I talked to parents about their burnout, I made sure to ask them, too, about what gives them great joy, and the answers were sublime. But the current organization of our society, of school, of work, of the way gender intersects with both, turns children into mini life bombs. Not them exactly so much as the expectations and financial and labor realities that accompany them. Every day, people decide that the wreckage is worth it. And to be fair, I had decided 10 years before that a different sort of wreckage, that of massive student loans, was worth it. And these days, children are much more valuable wrecking balls than a PhD. But the impulses that guide us toward these decisions remain the same. They just feel right, like the best possible choice we could make, like something we won't regret. Our hunger to reproduce, like our hunger for knowledge, creates a temporary amnesia, the ability to deny that the harsh lived reality will be that harsh or real for you. You could call that mindset millennial. I'm exceptional, and if I just work harder, things will be different for me. Or American, or just biologically human, as our minds trick us into reproducing our species. Our bodies, after all, have been doing something similar for millennia. Otherwise, how would you convince women to go through childbirth again and again and again? But the history of modern civilization is also the history of women gradually figuring out that they can have the same choices as men. First, to not have as many children, and then, today, to not have children at all. I made the decision not to have children. I understand that some might call it selfish, and that self-indulgence has become the necessary way to frame self-preservation. But if our society continues to make life hostile for parents in general, and mothers in particular, it's a decision that more and more millennials will entertain. In August 2019, NPR ran a piece on millennials titled Less Sex, Fewer Babies. That piece, like so many of its genre, blames the decline on online dating, more time on the internet, and young men and women prioritizing their careers. Rashmi Venkatesh, who's 30, married, and has a PhD in science, told NPR that she had envisioned a fully formed professional life and a fully formed family life. But she simply cannot envision what taking 3 or 4 months off for maternity leave would do to her career, or how she'd pay for continued care. That fully formed family life idea has gone by the wayside. Stories like Rashmi's and stories like mine are increasingly familiar. They're not just anecdotes. They accumulate to make significant statistical change. Between 2017 and 2018 alone, the birth rate dropped 2%. The total number of births hit a 32-year low. These people not having kids and enduring a sex drought, they're millennials. And while increased time on the internet, in dating apps, and career ambitions may be the direct cause for less sex and fewer children, the real cause is burnout. We spend more time on the internet because being on the internet is our job, or because we're so fatigued that the only thing we're up for during our approximation of leisure time is social media or a quick scroll of the news. We don't glom to dating apps because they make dating better, but because they make it optimizable, a line item we can attend to for 5 minutes between tasks. The actual number of dates goes down not because people don't know how to interpret online communication, as some suggest, but because actual dating, taking significant time to get to know someone or multiple someones, deters from the time you could be working. That, or you struggle mightily to convince yourself after a long day of staring at your computer that you have the energy to interact with anyone other than your pet on a personal level. We don't have less sex because we're less sexual. We have less sex because we're exhausted. We don't wait or opt against children because we love our career so much more than we love babies. We just struggle to see how our society, in its current configuration, will allow us to do both without losing ourselves in the process. Women are already second-class citizens. When they become mothers, they only become more so and have to work even harder to prove otherwise or live in a way that refuses that fate. For years, Americans have resigned themselves to burnout. Many of our parents did it in hopes of better, more secure, less burnt-out lives for us, And yet we still do it ourselves today. We work harder for less and blame our fatigue and precarity on our own failings instead of society's. But refusal to address burnout has consequences. On the individual, of course, but also on our country as a whole. This isn't speculation. Just look at Japan, where the fertility rate as of 2018 was just 1.42. To keep the country's population stable, not even growing, but stable, requires a 2.07 birth rate. But year after year, the number of births in Japan decrease. The birth rate in 2018 was the lowest since the country began keeping birth records, all the way back in 1899. In 1995, only 10% of Japanese women between the ages of 35 and 39 had never been married. In 2015, nearly a quarter of women in that age group were unmarried. Zoom out, and it's easy to see why. Once they are married, working women are still expected to perform the vast majority of labor in the homes and for their children. They spend hours hanging laundry, washing dishes, and cooking, and filling out the never-ending paperwork required for their children's preschools, logs of activities, daily records of activities and meals, sign-offs on every homework assignment. The Japanese version of Pinterest parenting is the elaborate packed lunch, complete with a theme. According to one study of government data, Japanese women who work more than 49 hours a week still do close to 25 hours of housework a week. Their husbands still average less than 5. And even if a man wants to contribute more to household duties, the corporate culture of overwork makes it nearly impossible. Workers in all fields are expected to regularly entertain clients and bosses in a way that eclipses American standards. To opt out is, well, not an option, which explains why, in 2018, only 6% of Japanese men working in the private sector actually took paternity leave. Of the full year available to working fathers, the average man took just 5 days. As Kumiko Nomoto, a professor of sociology at Kyoto University, told the New York Times, it's so obvious for a lot of women who have jobs that it's very difficult to find a man who is available to be a caretaker in the family. And burnout prevails. In 2017, employees at a quarter of Japanese companies were working more than 80 overtime hours, often unpaid, a month. Workers receive 20 vacation days of leave a year, but 35% of them don't use a single day. There's even a Japanese word, karoshi, to specifically describe death from overwork. That word came into wide use in the 1980s as Japan was on the path to global dominance. But back then, overwork also meant lifetime security. You dedicated yourself to a job that in turn dedicated itself to you and your family's long-term care. That's no longer the case. But workers' hours and corporate pressure remain steady. In recent years, the Japanese government has undergone efforts to staunch what it has come to view as a birth and labor crisis threatening the future of the nation as a whole. There have been pro-birth, pro-marriage campaigns, and premium Friday mandates, which force employers to allow all workers to leave at 3 p.m. on Friday on the last week of the month without deduction of pay, as well as attempts to curb compulsory overtime without pay. In January 2019, the country's environmental minister made headlines after announcing that he planned to take time off after the birth of his child. A whopping 2 weeks, spread over 3 months. But many Japanese remain skeptical that any of these changes will produce substantive change. Japanese working mothers no longer have to work until 10 p.m., but that doesn't mean that their husbands don't, or that those same women won't be overlooked for promotions or other opportunities in the workplace, simply because they couldn't evidence their dedication in the same manner as their male co-workers. Japan waited until it was at a crisis point, and only then decided to act. But those actions failed to holistically address both the culture of burnout and the gender imbalance that accompanies it. Faced with the prospect of working themselves into the ground on their own and excelling, or working themselves into the ground while also doing all the work for the family as their careers are stymied at every turn, it's no wonder that so many Japanese women are opting out of marriage, of motherhood, or the idea that womanhood requires either. Japan is unique, people will say. That won't happen here. But Japan's ideological compunctions and contradictions are no more or less unique than those of the United States or any other countries. What happened in Japan isn't unique, but instructive. A clear signal that when a society ignores, incentivizes, demands, or otherwise standardizes burnout, it compromises itself. The resulting imbalance might not be immediately apparent, but with time, cracks in a nation's most cherished ideological foundations, that hard work is rewarded, that the best succeed, that education is paramount, that things will work out, grow and become unwieldy. In America, we've attempted to fill those cracks with the quick fix of more work, more emails, more kids' activities, more social media posts. We keep going past the point of exhaustion, because what would happen if we didn't? But slowly, something has begun to shift. Maybe you broke down, but most likely you didn't. Maybe you got sick of reading too many life hack blog posts and wanted to throw your phone out the window. Maybe you went on vacation and felt nothing. Maybe you realized you were checking Instagram for seemingly no reason at a stoplight. Maybe it's happening right now as you read this book. Whatever that shift in your own life looks like, the revelation remains the same. It doesn't have to be this way. That's an incredibly liberating thought. That what we've been taught is just the way things are doesn't have to be. Just because we've reconciled ourselves to our current reality doesn't mean it's right. Because this is the truth, which becomes no less true if others have had to endure it. We shouldn't have to choose between excelling in work and thriving as individuals. We should feel good about listening to our bodies when they tell us, in every way they know how, that we should stop. Parenting shouldn't be a contest. Leisure shouldn't be this scarce. Domestic labor shouldn't even be close to this unequal. We shouldn't be this worried, this terrified, this anxious about everything. What if we don't resign ourselves to working until we or the planet dies? Or refuse to accept that shitty pay is just what we deserve if we do meaningful work? What if we refuse to allow work to seep into every crevice of our lives? The stock market shouldn't be our indication of economic health. Private equity should be banned or highly regulated. The rich shouldn't be nearly this rich, and the poor shouldn't be nearly this poor. And we shouldn't excuse any of these inexcusable realities in the name of old broken myths about who we are and what we stand for, particularly when their endurance only stands to benefit those already in power. We don't need anarchy per se, but we do need an acknowledgement of how close we are to collapse and how ready we are for substantive change. Both tendencies, after all, can be readily exploited. You can draw a crooked line between burnout and the despair and existential crises that accompany it, and white nationalism, virulent online misogyny, and neo-fascism. Instead of identifying the real reason for our emotional and financial precarity, millennials have and will turn their eyes and blame where directed. Toward other mothers, toward immigrants, toward people not like us or more scared than us. Desperation drives people to decisions that in the moment make some sort of sense and promise some sort of relief. Just because they're inexcusable doesn't mean they're not explainable. Burnout has enveloped our current iteration of capitalism. It inflects and infects every interaction. It haunts every decision. It dulls and flattens us. It's so familiar, we forget to be frightened by it. We're only just now beginning to see its long-term effects and treat them seriously. Which means that now, too, is the time to act. But I don't have a specific list of action items for you. I'm trying as best as I can to show, not tell. Every book I read about the economy or our unwitting addiction to our phones or the exhaustion of parenting, they all concluded with solutions. Some included handy checklists and little boxes of everyday tips that could change your day-to-day life. Some had extensive, detailed policy solutions. All of those ideas were compelling and interesting and deeply unhelpful. Just another way, in the end, for me to fail myself and the world. Which is why this project, from its original conception as an article to now, has never been about telling you what to do. I can't fix you when it's society that's broken you. Instead, I've tried to provide a lens for you to see yourself and the world around you clearly. So look at your life, at your thoughts about work, about your relationship to your kids, at your fears in your phone and your email account. Look squarely at your fatigue and remind yourself there's no app or self-help book or meal planning scheme that can lift it. It is a symptom of living as a millennial in the world today. And depending on your race and class and job and debt and immigration status, it is exacerbated even more. But you are not powerless to change it. You can't optimize yourself to beat it or work harder to make it go away faster. Because you can find and feel solidarity with so many others who feel, if not exactly the same, similarly. So here's what we can do. We can unite in our resistance to the way things are. We can refuse to blame ourselves for wide-scale societal failures, but also understand how fear of losing one's already tenuous standing makes us overly protective of the privileges we do have. We can recognize that it's not enough to try to make things better for ourselves. We have to make things better for everyone, which is why actual substantive change has to come from the public sector, and we must vote en masse to elect politicians who will agitate for it tirelessly. We don't have to value ourselves and others by the amount of work that we do. We don't have to resent our parents or grandparents for having it easier than us. We don't have to submit to the idea that racism or sexism will be with us forever. We can come to the spectacular and radical understanding that we are each valuable simply because we are. We can feel so much less alone, so much less exhausted, so much more alive. But there's a lot of work involved in realizing that the way to get there isn't, in fact, working more. Millennials have been denigrated and mischaracterized, blamed for struggling in situations that set us up to fail. But if we have the endurance and aptitude and wherewithal to work ourselves this deeply into the ground, we also have the strength to fight. We have little savings and less stability. Our anger is barely contained. We're a pile of ashes smoldering, a bad memory of our best selves. Underestimate us at your peril. We have so little left to lose.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Can't Even, How Millennials Became the Burnout Generation, written and performed by Anne Helen Peterson. Executive producers, Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Produced and directed by Chris Sacco. Copyright 2020 by Anne Helen Peterson. Sound recording copyright 2020 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.